little bit, I'll give a little bit of my love to you. There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, so much has occurred on this planet over the years, hundreds if not thousands of years ago, that we are just beginning to understand. We're only scratching the surface. Tonight, a special program on Coast to Coast AM where we talk about some of those events that may have occurred years ago and why those people during those civilizations were able to think the way they did. In a moment, our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck, on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel Pinchbeck is the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, and is a regular columnist for Arthur Magazine. He's currently completing a second book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and Indigenous Prophecies and Consciousness Transformation, to be released next spring. His feature articles have appeared in the New York Time Magazine, Esquire, Wired, The Village Voice, and numerous other publications. A founding editor of Open City, a literary journal, he is currently launching a new magazine and internet forum, Metascene, a magazine for the new edge, offering a new paradigm for a planetary culture. Our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel, is that Metascene or Metascene, spelled with a T instead of a D?
Medicine, spelled with a T, right? It's M-E-T-A-C-I-N-E, sort of a play on medicine.
What kind of magazine is it going to be?
Well, I mean, the basic idea is kind of like to put together an alternative paradigm, sort of economic, ecological, spiritual, shamanic, sort of put together a lot of ideas that people that I know have been exploring really carefully, and so take it up to a higher level of evaluation.
Well, you know, there's so much going on here with Hopi prophecy, the Mayans, and just about everything else. It's almost like I don't know which way to start, except the best thing I think for us to do is to talk a little bit about your first book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. Because I think through the shamans who really deal with the consciousness, that these people were able to really tap into what might be going on in the universe. And I think that may be the bearing for all these other things that you've investigated. Am I close on that?
I think definitely. I mean, what happened with the first book is I sort of started out as a secular atheist, materialist, New York journalist. And I went through a series of shamanic investigations. I went to West Africa, I went through tribal initiation in Gabon. Then I went down to the Amazon in Ecuador and visited a Mazatec shaman in Mexico. And began to have, you know, various like psychic and synchronistic and even magical events and occurrences, which by the end of the book had completely changed my view over to the shamanic perspective. And that really became the basis for the next book, because having had these experiences, I then had to question, you know, not only the materialist sort of paradigm, which is the functioning belief system of the modern world, but then also realize that if these other cultures had this other level of knowledge, that we should also take seriously what they're suggesting about what's going to happen in the future.
Because this planet has not necessarily evolved well spiritually, but it has evolved in terms of technologically, do we have more shamans on this planet than we did 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think it's a question of evolving better or worse. I mean, I think everything is going, like, you know, what I ended up, first having gone through a kind of apocalyptic crisis where I freaked out after going to the Amazon and seeing the kind of devastation caused by the oil companies and so on. I went through a kind of, you know, and then reading tons and tons about the ecological problems on the planet. I first got very depressed about what was going on. But my present state of mind, having sort of gone through a whole other process, is that actually everything is going perfectly according to plan. And we're in a kind of evolutionary process. And part of that process is that sort of different aspects of human potential get sort of accessed in different time periods. And we've gone through a time period where kind of the, you know, left brain, rightness, male, rational, dominator kind of mentality has sort of taken over and pushed things in a certain direction and accelerated the evolution of technology. And I would say that part of the fulfillment of the prophecies in 2012 would be a kind of rebalancing of the hemispheres and a kind of equalizing of the intuitive, magical, and spiritual.
Daniel, do you find that the Mayans and the Hopis are matching in some of their prophecies and revelations?
I think it all looks pretty, like, coherent to me. I mean, it looks pretty matched up. If you look at the Mayans, the Hopis, the Aztecs, and even you can throw in the, you know, the Hindus and the Book of Revelation, it actually all looks pretty, like, aligned.
We'll get into the message in a moment, but what would your theory then be why these different cultures, some of them different time periods, would all have similar ends to the same thing? They'd all point in the same direction. How come?
Well, because they were, you know, because the knowledge is available. I mean, if you look at contemporary physics, you know, they talk about how, you know, the space-time we're in is only sort of a one linear form of space-time. There's a kind of transcendent dimension where all things, you know, have already occurred. I mean, the physicist Eddington talked about how events do not really happen. They are just there and we come upon them. And that's exactly what the Hopis say. I mean, they say that all time is present now. So these other cultures had means of kind of beaming into other layers of the onion, in a sense.
Set the stage. What would you prefer that we talk about first, the Mayans or the Hopis?
I guess the Mayans is good.
Okay. Now, let's talk about their culture. Who were these people, Daniel?
Well, the Mayans are located in the Yucatan, and they had a wide-ranging culture. They just developed in the earlier Olmecs. And then they really took off in terms of they became incredibly sophisticated. I mean, in terms of their art, in terms of their spiritual culture, and they left these extraordinary temple cities behind, in Palenque and Tikal and Chichen Itza. And then they very mysteriously and very suddenly disappeared. And, you know, various modern historians and archaeologists have tried to make cases that there was some, you know, sudden ecological collapse. But I don't know how good the evidence for that is, how much we're actually just projecting our own kind of materialist thought structure onto them.
And you know, even though we have heard, of course, that the Mayans were incredibly intelligent, probably way beyond their time, we're also finding out now that their rituals were also pretty barbaric. You know, human sacrifices, part of their religion, part of their beliefs. Is that a fair assessment to say barbaric, or did they actually believe then that they were doing something good?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Mayans, as opposed to the Aztecs, were very limited users of human sacrifice. It wasn't as large-scale a practice. And, I mean, and there was also, I mean, actually the sort of the story of Quetzalcoatl, who kind of emerged at the end of the Mayan period, is that he actually abolished human sacrifice for a time. But they were always interested in using blood as a kind of psycho-physical magic generator, I guess, to sort of contact other levels of being. And to some extent, that certainly violates contemporary morality. I mean, of course, you know, our civilization is also quite barbaric and sacrifices people in all sorts of ways. So I think we have to be a little careful, you know, about projecting onto them without really having a deeper understanding.
Well, when you say our society, you're talking about the planet?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, I mean, we sacrifice, you know, children in the third world to work in factories to make.
Well, that's what I mean, then, a planetary thing.
I mean, you know, we don't do direct human sacrifices, but we find other ways to extract toil and blood from people. So I don't think that the classical Maya were actually huge practitioners of human sacrifice. I mean, I think it was a small part of their religious practice.
The year 2012 comes up all the time on this program, Daniel. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of it? I mean, why did it end at 2012? And tell us a little bit about the Mayan calendar in general.
Right. Well, I mean, the Mayans were obsessed with cycles of time. I mean, that's another thing that makes it very strange that they had such a sudden disappearance, and that they were obsessed with huge cycles of time. I mean, if you go back to their, you know, their kind of stelae and stuff, they have hieroglyphs which represent. There's one called the Aloton, which is like 43 million years, and there's another glyph which is the Halopton, which is 1.3 billion years. So they were looking at time in this incredibly macrocosmic scale, and you know, from, I mean, I'm not an archaeologist, so I can't say from the primary sources, but from the various books that I've read and the people that I've spoken with, the idea is that the Mayan calendar itself kind of ends in 2012, in that there's this kind of psychical progression. And the people who've been examining it to a deep degree, which includes José Aguirreles and the Swedish biologist Carl Johan Kalman, believe that the Mayans had a kind of fractal model of time that they were looking at as a kind of spiraling process linked to consciousness, and that it goes through these different stages and levels of consciousness evolution, which complete the process on the Earth in 2012.
Now, so many people nowadays interpret 2012 and all kinds of incredible, incredible possibilities. Some say we're going to go through a massive polar shift, and the Mayans knew about that. A magnetic field shift is going to occur. Some say that it's probably the end of time, that maybe we're going to get hit by an asteroid, and the Mayans have prophesied that. Others simply say, the calendar ended because it just ended. So with all these possibilities out there, were you able to simulate just what you think might be happening here?
Right. Well, I think that it is going to be a massive transformation in human consciousness to a different level of realization. And I think that's really the key aspect of it. And I think we're going to move into a harmonic and utopian situation on the planet, you know, obviously after passing through some turbulence first. You know, other stuff is, to me, seems sort of speculative. I mean, there may be disasters on the way, but I think it's more important. You know, we tend to get very obsessed with the negative in our culture, and I think it's very important to look at the positive aspects. And you know, I mean, one way that, you know, it's very sort of clear to think about it is that if we're in a period where all of this darkness seems present, it may be because light casts a shadow, and that we're focusing on the shadow rather than seeing the light behind it.
I've always said that it could be a period of enlightenment for all of us.
Right. Well, I think that would be what I would say also. But the question, but the thing about it is that we actually have to do the work. I mean, to bring that into being, and that's something I think that often gets missed when you sort of focus on a date. It sort of feels like it's just going to happen. But actually, I would say it's like an incredible opportunity for us to make something happen. And if we look at the world, I mean, even, you know, I mean, I think it's, a, I mean, for many reasons, I think that the projection is probably accurate, having thought about all their reasons for it. But even beyond that, it gives us a kind of opportunity to, you know, plan, reshape, rethink, I mean, and to figure out how we're going to move into a different framework. Because clearly the, you know, sort of social system we have now is not functioning and is not compassionate and not worth sticking with.
And sometimes whatever that end date is, 2012, maybe it's something cyclical as well. Maybe they were able to predict things occurring, earth changes, because of past cycles.
Well, it's not, yeah, I mean, basically the whole idea is that it's a kind of non-dual perspective, and that the evolution of consciousness on the earth is synchronized with larger cosmic patterns and cosmic cycles. So one aspect is the kind of, there's an astronomical alignment that happens on December 21st, 2012, where the sun rises during the winter solstice at the dark rift in the center of the Milky Way. And the Mayans talked about this dark rift as being the black hole or the cosmic mother. And, you know, astronomers only in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years discovered there is actually an enormous black hole right at that spot.
So how would they know about it? The Mayans, they didn't have telescopes.
Exactly. Well,
they didn't have anything.
I mean, the two possibilities, which Jenkins and Arguelles kind of discuss, is either they, through visionary psychedelic exploration, had sort of a deeper understanding of kind of energy patterns in the universe, and somehow could sense it, you know, extrasensorily, through ritual use of psychedelics, or they actually are a kind of galactic civilization that sort of appeared at Earth, on the Earth at that point, to leave all this information about time and synchronicity and harmonic resonances behind for us to kind of pick up again at this point as we pass through this transition.
Well, and I think you're absolutely correct. It's probably one of the other. Either they had some kind of an enlightened period through, as you say, some of these psychedelics, which we'll talk about in a moment, where they were able to travel remote view to do whatever they could do and travel throughout the universe that way. If indeed these theories are correct as well, that we have the ability to do this, they might have been able to do that. Or, as you've said, they were extraterrestrial visitors who came here, or they were visited as well, Daniel. That's a possibility, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, right, or it may also be both or all three, you know. I mean,
right.
The alien may actually manifest to us as us, you know. I mean, that in a way has been an implication of the experiences I've had on the way of doing this.
That leads us, of course, into Quetzalcoatl, who is part of your new book. He came during the Mayans' last period. Who was this person?
Right, well, Quetzalcoatl is one of the creator deities of the Aztecs. I guess he was actually Kukulkan to the Mayans. But he's a kind of figure who was part of the creation myth, in that he went into the underworld and gathered up the bones of destroyed humanity at the end of the fourth sun, which was the previous world cycle. And he sort of carried them tenderly up to the surface and restored them to life. And you know, literally, it's the plumed serpent, or the Quetzal is a sort of rainbow feathered bird of the region, and Coatl is the serpent. So the Quetzalcoatl as a symbol represents kind of the union of the bird, which is air, heaven, spirit, and the serpent, which is earth. You know, body, matter. So it's an image of heaven and earth integration.
Was he a real person?
Well, there were, you know, much like the Tibetan Buddha of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, has human incarnations, including the present Dalai Lama. And each Dalai Lama is considered to be an incarnation of the Buddha of Compassion. Quetzalcoatl had, on occasion, human incarnations. And he had one in kind of a previous or prehistoric phase of Mesoamerican development, where he was kind of the bearded culture hero who disseminated kind of arts and sciences to the people. And then he had a 10th century incarnation as Quetzalcoatl, who sort of was ultimately foiled by the sorcerers of Tezcatlipoca, his nemesis.
You know the names.
Yeah, and ended up sort of prophesying his return on a certain date, which turned out to be the date that Cortez arrived in the New World, which completely kind of destroyed the confidence of Montezuma and the Aztecs, basically just collapsed.
Is it possible that Quetzalcoatl was an alien god or something like that?
Well, I mean, the word alien almost becomes unnecessary. I mean, he was a kind of god form, or in a way a kind of symbolic archetype.
Right.
You know, I mean, one definite sort of lens I'm looking at a lot of this material at in the book is the Jungian lens, you know, which is sort of the idea that there are archetypes that constellate or crystallize over time.
Oh, well, I mean, do you think he was a figment of a great Mayan imagination, or do you think he was a real person?
Well, I think that the imagination is the only thing that's real. as William Blake, I think, said. So I would say he was both.
Indeed, he was.
I mean, one of the interesting things about Maya, as Arguelles points out, is that the word itself is a kind of tell, because, you know, in Buddhism and Hinduism, Maya is a very important concept. It means the world of illusion. It also means the magical creative power of the gods. So it's a very strange little quirk that the same word Maya, you know, which has all that meaning in the Eastern philosophy, then is the name of this culture in the Western Hemisphere.
We'll come back, talk about this. And part of your investigation, of course, deals with crop formations as well. We'll talk about that when we come back with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and 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 miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles.
From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, for you StreamLink members, Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Lex has lined up Dr. Michio Kaku for you for the Tuesday night chat. That'll be something indeed, so make sure you're part of that Tuesday night. After Dark, well, make sure you're a part of the After Dark CD, too. You get two of those. And 2.5 hours of great bumper music, unforgettable calls to the show, classic ghost stories as well. Go to the website afterdarkcd.com, afterdarkcd.com, or call this toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331, 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with our guest tonight, Daniel Pinchback. Daniel, in your research, of course, you looked into the crop circles, crop formations situation. Let's talk about just why you even approached that angle.
Right. Well, I guess it started, I got interested in it, you know, when I'd written my first book, and I'd had these various kind of shamanic and sort of, not demonic, but daimonic kind of experiences. And I wondered, you know, where one could find sort of consensual validation for this kind of worldview. And I realized there was this whole phenomenon going on, which I'd really never paid any attention to. I mean, it really doesn't get any play in the mainstream media. You never see images of it in the Times or anywhere. So, you know, I just, through the Internet, began to look at the patterns, and I was totally astonished by how incredible they were. I mean, just their incredible beauty and their incredible scale. And then I got an assignment from Wired magazine to write about the crop circles. It was around the time that horrible movie Signs came out.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got to interview a bunch of the researchers and sort of thinkers about it. And then, you know, one of them, this guy Michael Glickman, who's been researching for decades in England, said that he felt that they were linked to a dimensional shift that was had already begun and was going to culminate in the year 2012. And since that was already a subject that fascinated me, I realized I had to go over there. So I went over there for two summers and spent a lot of time in the fields and talked to everybody I could who was involved with it, including some of the hoaxers, and tried to get a really kind of multi-level perspective on it.
What did the hoaxers tell you? I mean, how were they able to do that and not get seen? What did they say?
There are people who are very strident that humans are entirely responsible for the phenomenon, and that it's a sort of postmodern artwork, and that somehow they're able to, you know, pull them all off virtuosically in the dark. And then there are, you know, other people who say that's fundamentally impossible, that even sort of surveying and laying them out would be a monumental feat. And then there are scientists such as this Dutch physicist, Elcho Hasselhoff, who wrote a book called The Deepening Complexity of Crop Circles. And he's actually published papers in peer-reviewed science journals that demonstrate that the plants are affected in such a way that the patterns that he studied had to be created by a single point source of electromagnetic radiation coming from above. And, you know, his science was good enough that it was, you know, in sort of conventional science papers that are peer-reviewed. So the more I thought about and sort of studied the phenomenon, the more of an incredible conundrum the whole thing seemed to be. And I basically, you know, I reached a point where I couldn't even sleep at night. I was staying in Glastonbury in England. Because it was just so fascinating, and there were so many different perspectives on it. And what finally, my sort of final Satori flash on the subject was that I think that the whole phenomenon is a teaching on the nature of reality that's geared specifically for the kind of Western mindset. And part of this teaching is definitely sort of introducing us into this kind of reality shift that we're going through, or as Michael Glickman says, dimensional shift. And part of it is about the nature of causality itself is changing, in that what basically seems to happen with the crop formations is that whoever comes into that the field and begins to study it, their own mindset gets kind of reflected back to them, sort of magnified. So if somebody comes in and is skeptical, you know, they'll find all of the indications that that patterns are hoaxed. Obviously, the hoaxers will, you know, find everything that corroborates their belief that, right, you know, they're the ones with the right attitude. And, you know, people who are sort of new age bliss bunnies will go and have like 13-dimensional channel experiences and feel their DNA is being tuned up by light beings. But if you go in there with a, you know, completely open and, but, you know, skeptical but open perspective, you begin to take in all these different layers of conflicting data. And the pattern itself, the whole phenomenon seems to kind of create this kind of cognitive dissonance, which is typical for a lot of these phenomena. If you look at the alien abductions or, you know, shamanism in general, there's a whole trickster element to it, which seems to be like part, sort of woven into the fabric of it. So I began to realize the whole thing was an incredible teaching on the nature of reality that has all these other levels. I mean, a lot of the patterns relate to fractals, to scientific ideas, strange attractors, but in many cases they're sort of suggesting, or they seem to be suggesting, a kind of merging of the Western scientific and sort of Eastern metaphysic frameworks into a kind of new synthesis.
We had Hasselhoff on as a guest nearly 4 years ago, and he published articles in some pretty prestigious journals about crop circles and formations. I mean, he looked at it pretty seriously, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, his book is really pretty good. I mean, and another whole element to me relates very much to the Quetzalcoatl symbol. So there's a whole element of the integration of heaven and earth. I mean, there's a whole interest in sacred geometry. There was Gerald Hawkins, who wrote a book about Stonehenge, who was the chief of astronomy at Boston University. He found all of these incredibly complex Euclidean theorems, sort of new Euclidean paradigms, as he studied even really simple formations.
What if we are sharing this planet, Daniel, with in other dimensions, for example, and that sometimes, for whatever reason, it crosses over. Maybe crop circles is a way for them to communicate in their dimension. Who knows? But somehow it leaks through, and we see some of them too. I mean, are some of these things possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to frame it. I mean, you know, my feeling is that it probably is being orchestrated by some kind of federation of galactic intelligence, and that once we get through this strange transition period, we'll get to meet these guys.
and also be able to figure out what these things mean, because I'm sure they're sending us a message, aren't they?
Well, I think there. Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible to tease out some of the messages now, and more of it, you know, comes out as one works deeper into it. I mean, there've also been different sort of forms of the crop circles. There's been these kind of pictograms, which are kind of like alien sign language, and then ones which, as I said, are very much related to sacred geometry. You know, the geometry that's used in Stonehenge and the pyramids. I mean, they're very much related to the stone circles in England. This kind of Neolithic culture,
yes,
which had you know, a deep fascination with the relationship between the Earth and the Moon and the Sun, and kind of placing us in this cosmic harmonic order, which once again relates to the whole Mayan calendar situation, which is basically the idea that we've become kind of desynchronized from natural time. And we've created a sort of calendar and a whole way of thinking about time, or way of being in time, which is unnatural.
Well, you know, with all the crop circles, Daniel, with all of them that have occurred, if just one is authentic, then that tells you something dramatic about everything that's been going on. And you don't need to have 20% real, 40% real. All you need is one. That's
it. You're right. I mean, authentic is a complicated term. But I definitely think that the entire phenomenon is a teaching, and there's certainly, you know, I mean, evidentially ones that there's really doesn't seem any way that human beings could have made them, including there was in the year I think 1994 there were several formations which showed a particular alignment to the solar system, and that then turned out to, you know, astronomers looked at it and they projected that was going to be one night in April in 1999. And when that night happened, it would turn out to be the largest solar storm in history, and you could actually see the northern lights from England. And you know, we don't have any way of predicting a solar storm of that magnitude. So it definitely suggests that we're being keyed into information from other sources.
Why is it that mainstream science on a regular basis hasn't investigated crop formations and really tried to do a thorough job? Or do they simply believe that this stuff is all perpetrated by fraud?
Well, I mean, it's not just the science, but it's also, you know, journalists, media, the sort of mainstream mind. I mean, I think it's very much like, it's very similar to psychedelics in that these areas have had to kind of just develop outside of the dominator paradigm, outside of the mainstream culture. And it becomes very much an individual decision whether to become interested in them, to investigate, to care, which to me really suggests a lot about how the transition, you know, is going to sort of manifest itself. It's very much about the individual consciousness being able to exercise its own kind of free-willing curiosity outside of these kind of imposed structures that have kind of limited our frame of reference.
You are a believer in extraterrestrial life, I guess, right?
Well, I'm not really a believer in anything, but...
What?
I mean, it seems completely plausible that there, you know, could be galactic intelligences, and it seems like the way they would manifest would be in a much subtler way than, you know, tin cans spiraling around, you know, as UFOs. I think that as our minds stretch, we will begin to encompass these other realities, but it happens in very subtle domains to begin with.
Now you said something pretty fascinating to me, though, that you're not a believer in anything. Is that until you find the right proof?
Right. I mean, I totally agree with Carl Jung, who said, I believe only what I know. You know, I mean, once I've had an experience and I know it, then you know, I can support it, you know.
The the entire area, and I'm going to devote next hour to talking to you about the Hopi and then some other issues too, but this crop formation phenomena, since it occurred, has really got me baffled, quite frankly. We have a reporter who does a pretty thorough job investigating these, Daniel, Linda Moulton Howe. She's convinced that they're coming from outside sources. And I just think it seems to be leading more and more directly to something dimensional, some kind of communication from the universe. If all that is true, what the heck are they trying to tell us? I mean, why are they doing this?
Right. Well, I mean, I once again, I look at the Jungian perspective, which is like, you know, the process that we're going through, which is also, in a way, the process of apocalypse itself. It's kind of a sidereal movement of consciousness. You know, he talks about the mandala, which comes up in dreams a lot, and it's a symbol of wholeness. And, you know, a lot of the circles are kind of mandala patterns. And the mandala as a symbol of wholeness cannot be approached directly. There's a kind of side reel or spiraling movement as one approaches it. And that's what I think we're going through, you know, on many levels. And that's part of the crop circle phenomenon. And, you know, as I said, I think they're trying to tell us that we are on the verge of integrating esoteric wisdom traditions with modern scientific knowledge. And that once we do that, which is also an integration of kind of left and right hemisphere, intuitive and rational thought, feminine and masculine aspects, heaven and earth, once we manage to accomplish that integration, we move into this new framework of consciousness where, you know, things are possible that we can't even imagine from this point.
I wonder what they think of us as a society, as people.
Well, I think Michael Glickman was telling me that he's sort of investigated from all angles. He went to a channel or medium in L.A. who was able to contact the crop circle intelligences, and he asked them, you know, what do you guys think of us? And they answered, the sort of collective troop, well, we think you're hilarious. They said basically that they see us as kind of like bumbling figures in an old movie, kind of like Laurel and Hardy.
Well, at least they have a sense of humor, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the crop circles, I think, have an incredible sense of humor. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I mean, the phenomenon, and it's really also, it's very much about learning how to pay attention. It's very much about specificity. And I feel that that's very much about what's happening in terms of the change in consciousness, is that, you know, what we have in terms of our mainstream paradigm is this kind of imposition of an abstract grid of rationality. But what actually seems to be indicated is learning to just pay more and more particular, careful attention to subtler levels of reality. So, I mean, in these crop circles, there are these little nests in the center, which, you know, are sort of presented like incredible artworks, sort of woven together strand by strand. I mean, there are all these little details to the whole thing, or they'll find one thistle plant in a huge field of wheat, and they'll center the whole formation right on this one thistle plant, which they won't touch.
Well, you're talking about consciousness, and it sounds like you have a cold, Dan. You're going to be okay for
cough.
Okay. Get yourself a little cough medicine, sit by, and stick around for a couple more hours. the ability for people, I think, to investigate, to communicate, one day may become well known to all of us. As like you say, they think we're funny, quite frankly. Right now we're in our, it's like looking at a funny baby, even though some of the things we do on this planet are pretty darn sad and serious. The visitations, do you believe that we have been visited by extraterrestrials?
I think it's possible. I mean, I'm really into the whole Terence McKenna idea of the, you know, he had this sort of contact with the mushroom,
right,
as a kind of alien or galactic probe or alien mind. And, you know, I do think that the Mayan culture probably does represent some other level of galactic intelligence. I mean, as does the Tibetan Buddhists. I mean, they, you know, they completely talk about being in contact with, you know, kind of Buddhas from Buddha fields and sort of hyperdimensional spaces and stuff.
And a lot of this contact, though, is based on using psychedelics. Who's to say that the mind hasn't just created this because of the use of the psychedelics?
All right. Well, I mean, I support the, I mean, there's this physicist, Amit Goswami, wrote a book called Self-Aware Universe, following up on the Tao of Physics by Friedhof Capra. I mean, it's a whole now well-developed line of thinking in physics that the only way to really explain all of the paradoxes of quantum physics is to begin with consciousness being fundamental to reality, and the consciousness is actually, on a certain level, creating reality, self-organizing into sort of back into its original kind of state of freedom and full potentiality. So that's what I think is going on. So in a sense, yeah, the mind has created the whole thing.
But does it need mood-altering psychedelics to do that, or can we do it without that?
Well, I mean, the Tibetans do it without it. But I definitely think they can be useful as tools.
Maybe they augment it even grander than you could without it.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. I mean, I think that the Western consciousness is a more investigative, kind of pragmatic, tool-oriented consciousness than the East. So, you know, these are tools, and they're also, you know, provided naturally by the planet for our investigation.
Well, but you know, when you hear the word psychedelic, a lot of people think we're talking about drugs. You're talking about people using drugs. That's not the case, is it?
Well, language is very powerful, and that language really shapes reality.
Yes.
So, you know, when you use a language like that, then you shape the reality in a certain way, which also shapes the kind of experience that you can have. I would say that they're tools and they're medicines. You know, I think ayahuasca, which is the one from the Amazon, is, an incredible medicine for kind of healing the spirit and the soul.
Well, and shamans swear by it, if I could use that word. Your website, BreakingOpenTheHead.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The book we're talking about, the other one, the new book that are you close to completing that?
Yeah, it's almost done.
And when do you think it'll hit the stands?
It won't be out for another year.
Okay, so it will be next spring, not this spring.
Exactly.
All right, stay with us. Daniel Pinchbeck, our guest. We're going to talk about the Hopi prophecy when we come back, open up Fast Blast later on, and then take phone calls our last hour, give you an opportunity to chat with him. And still there's much more to talk about with the Mayans. And, you know, that 2012 date, I keep looking at it. It's not that far away. The clock just keeps ticking. I'm George Norrie. Coast to Coast AM continues in a moment.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with StreamLink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.